Welcome to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peach. What if the most honest portrait of humanity isn't found in books or surveys, but in our search engine data? This week, we're joined by data journalist and author Simon Rogers, whose new book is called What We Ask Google. It dives into 20 years of Google searches to uncover what we're really curious about, from late night questions about babies and sleep to the timeless how to tie a tie. Our searches reveal a shared, surprisingly hopeful story, because it turns out we're not just searching, we're connecting ourselves to humanity. Simon Rogers, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me, Lynn.
Well, first off, you're also a co-host of the Data Journalist podcast. So what do you spend your days doing as a data journalist, a data editor at Google?
So my background is in telling stories with data. And I should say, you know, this isn't about maths or numbers, if those are the kind of things that put you off. I mean, when I was in school, I hated maths. But for me, it's about using this information that's out there, that's, you know, publicly available. And, you know, Google Trends data is actually the biggest, world's biggest kind of publicly available data set. And using that to really, like, think about what it says about us as humans. So for Google, we work on these big projects, things like Year in Search, times when Google Trends kind of shows up in the outside world. But we also kind of work on, you know, supporting people who need Google Trends data, whether it's NGOs or newsrooms or whoever it is. And I guess, like, some people ask, like, what that means to be a data storyteller. And I suppose I would say, yeah, we've never had more data out there in the world than we have right now. So it's really trying to make sense of it for people, because otherwise data is just numbers. It doesn't mean anything until you can make it mean something, where you show people something that means something to them about their lives.
As you're saying, you're not really like a data analyst, because that might involve more numbers and math and things like that.
Yeah,
but you're a storyteller. You're a sociologist to a certain degree, would you say?
I guess so, yeah. In a way, sometimes I feel like an archaeologist, because you're kind of seeing things that have never been uncovered before through this data, and the fact that it's available to everybody. It's a new thing, really, to have this. You know, 30 years ago, we wouldn't have had this to play with, but it can tell us something really meaningful about who we are, I guess.
Right. So when we all think about when we started Googling things, we started using Google, when Google became a verb, in fact, you know, I remember it as back in the early 2000s. I know Google's been around since mid to late 90s and IPO in 2004. But when did Google start gathering all of this data?
Yeah. So Google Trends is what it's called. And you can actually go to it. Anybody listening can go to trends.google.com to play with the site and explore whatever they're interested in. But it started with a guy called Hal Varian, who was Google's chief economist. And he had spotted that there were interesting things about Google Trends, that you could almost see how people were intending to do stuff, whether it's book a vacation or buy a house or buy a car. And he started to think about it as an economist. And so him and a guy called Yossi Matthias basically came up with this idea of Google Trends. So the Google Trends data set, it goes back to 2004. It's kind of a random sample of all searches, because obviously there are billions of searches. And everything is kind of anonymized and aggregated. And by aggregated, I mean it's like, you see the data down to city level, but no further. So you might see in Park City, for instance, you could see the data for there, or you see the data for Utah, but you're not going to see it any lower than that. And there's all these privacy kind of restrictions as well. So what it gives you instead is basically a sense of the things that we care about long term and how those things have changed over time.
It'd be really interesting to know how we have evolved as a species, as a user, as a Googler, from our first searches to now, because I noticed this. Well, I noticed this maybe more with AI, that I started off using it as kind of an advanced Google, and now it's going into these other things. So you evolve as you search. Have you found that, you know, going back to 20 years?
Yeah. I mean, I would say, like, you can see social trends through it. So, for instance, mm-hmm. one of the things you'll notice is that searches for take care of parents have spiked above searches for take care of kids. And, you know, that actually represents this thing they call the sandwich generation, which is a lot of us where we're looking after our kids and looking after our parents. And so when you see something which you know is happening out there in the world, but it's reflected in the data, it's really interesting. So you can often see these kind of social changes through the data. And then there's right now, there's this kind of revolution in search happening where people are searching in different ways because of AI. So whereas in the past, you might say, find me a restaurant near me. Now you're going to put a query that's much longer. You might say, find me a restaurant near me where I can stay till midnight with a group of friends and bring a cake and that sort of thing. So queries are definitely getting more specific and longer. I would say that I think the things we search for are probably staying the same. You know, we search for our families or our pets or our parenting or our, you know, food or health, whatever it is. But the way that we search is definitely kind of evolving and changing over time.
Absolutely. So it's spring now. Well, in Park City, it doesn't seem very much like spring. I think we're getting our winter now that we didn't get back in February. But nevertheless, there are plants out there trying to grow. Obviously, you're going to see a trend for spring, right? So what are those trends? Are they allergies and how to start bulbs when you forgot to do it last fall, or what are they?
Yeah, so basically people search for different things at different times of year. So this time of year, yeah, gardening is something we really search for. It's also planning summer vacations, those kind of things. But you also see things, other things like in December is the peak time for people searching for how to play piano because maybe they're thinking about the holidays. So, you know, there is this thing where people look for different things, different times of year. This time of year is also people searching for promposal because, you know, we're in April, May, and that is the time, the peak time for getting ready for prom. So, yeah, there's these patterns of kind of, we call them almost like rhythmic searches that happen every year, but they happen at different moments during the year. And even during the day, there are things that spike at different times of day. For instance, around 2 a.m., people search for the words baby and sleep. So, you know, and that's wherever you are in the world. So there's some of those things that are unifying in a way. And actually, when I started doing the book, I'm looking at those kind of everyday trends. You see how much unites us in terms of like all looking for the similar things at similar times.
Right. Well, I know that when you've been thinking about writing this book for a while, and I know that it started off quite personal for you, and it was after the loss of your mom, right? Yeah. And grief is something that unites us all, that we unfortunately all have to go through at some point. And so how did you approach that? And what did these trends tell you about grief?
Yeah, so basically, I had the idea of doing the book. And I thought, well, my mum had passed, and I thought, well, I should write the grief chapter first because it'll be the hardest one to do. And because for everybody listening to this who's been through this, it's, you feel very alone. You feel like you're the only person this has ever happened to, when obviously you know objectively that's not true, but you know. And you feel like nobody could possibly understand what you're going through. And actually, when I started looking at the data, what I saw was that other people are going through the same thing. And they're asking the same questions as you. And not only that, there are other people who are asking questions about how to support you, whether it's what's the right thing to say, or what can I do to help someone who's grieving, or, you know, that line of poetry that seems appropriate, or a reading, whatever it might be. And I think that realization that actually these things are things that will happen to all of us. You're not really, you might feel lonely, but you're not alone in that moment, is really powerful to me. And then the other thing really was that people want to help each other. And you see that often. People want to help others who are going through stuff, whether it's because you see a disaster on TV or because you know somebody who's going through something. And so you see like searches for how to help are higher than ever before. Searches for donate are higher than ever before. And seeing that was another reason I wanted to do it. And there's also the fact that, and this really comes through in the data, is that we don't know anything. We think we do, and we think there are lots of things that we should know. Like people think, you know, people ask questions like how to tie a tie or how to boil an egg. And how to boil an egg is actually like one of the top searched food questions of all time. But it's always the top search, which says to me that people have to search it again and again. So we might know something and then forget how to do it. And then how to tie a tie. Honestly, a lot of people don't wear ties anymore, do they? I mean, certainly when I was at school, we had to wear a tie, you know, and my first job, I had to wear a tie. I don't know anybody who does now. And so for my son, say, who is going to prom next week, you know, he'll need me to help him show him how to tie a tie, which is interesting. So you can see those kind of changes too. But yeah, I think it came out of that feeling of going through a very intense experience and then wondering how other people experience that same thing.
Absolutely. And I was thinking about this because I was going through your chapter titles and, you know, one, I was thinking, how many of these have I done in the last week, you know, and or month or whatever. And I have queried about gravity after Artemis II was happening and we were interviewing about that. And I just had these questions that I'd never had answered about gravity. But also my husband and I were sort of arguing about how long you should be leave an egg boiling to boil an egg. And I was saying, right. No, 15 minutes does not cut it. We live really at high altitudes. So 15 minutes doesn't cut it.
Yeah.
Yes. So I have looked up how to boil an egg. And and so I guess a lot of them do. It's not like you're Googling these things in social isolation. Maybe you're talking about it. Maybe when you are helping your son tie his tie for prom, you then go to Google because your son will say, no, you're wrong, Dad.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no, he won't believe it, just me. I'll need backup for that for sure.
And, you know, so it's kind of maybe it's a consensus builder or something like that. Because this is what you're talking about in the book, how this is actually, it's surprisingly hopeful. And that's wonderful. So maybe you could comment on that this is not, what you do is not a depressing job. You actually find hope for humanity in it.
Now, I keep getting asked if it's depressing all the time. And actually, I don't find that. And, you know, I didn't set out to write an optimistic book. It just came through in the data again and again that we needed to, we definitely searched for how to help each other. We want to do the right thing. And that was something that, like I say, it wasn't intentional on my part. It just came naturally through. The big things that people search for are things like the weather or movies or music. And it's not to say that you can't go hunting for things that are less kind of savory, I guess. But that's not the kind of the vast majority of people's lives and experience.
I'm wondering if in some way it's because we feel like anytime we put that information out there, those kinds of queries out there, that it's going to follow us somehow.
I mean, I would say it's like, it's different to, I mean, firstly, yeah, like the data is all anonymous, firstly, but it's very different to how you present yourself on social media. I think if you're on social media, and, you know, most people aren't, right? But if you are, then you're presenting yourself to the world. You're looking, you want to look a certain way. Well, when you're searching for something, it's really because you genuinely care about it or you genuinely are interested in it. So for me, they're very different data sets, and there's an honesty to the data, which I love. And I think that it's kind of underutilized in a way. Like, I think it can really teach us a lot about who we are and what we care about.
I heard you saying about, like, if there was an alien culture who had discovered Earth and were trying to learn about Earth, they should buy your book. Because really, this is how you...
I like intergalactic sales. I think you could, you know, if you didn't know anything about humans, but you could look at search data, it would tell you everything you need to know, the stuff that we really care about, how we want to help each other, you know, the good stuff that we want to do. You would see that in the data. And that, to me, is incredibly powerful.
Absolutely. Why does my dog eat grass? That's one I've looked up before. I bet so many people have. You just really want to get to the meat of it. But that's one of your chapters.
Yeah, pet searches are so interesting because we ascribe so much to our animals. I'm sitting in a room with a dog at the moment who's curled up on the floor, and things like, does my dog know that I love them? Or how to say I love you in dog is another search. That's what I was waiting. So people definitely feel this emotional connection. You see that coming through. But then some of it is I just don't understand. So for instance, I looked at searches for can you keep whatever as a pet, thinking, oh, it's going to be like, can you keep a raccoon as a pet? And there is, people do search for can you keep a raccoon as a pet, which I don't recommend. But they also ask, can you keep a panda as a pet? Like, and I'm going to tell you, no. Firstly, no, you can't keep a panda as a pet. But also, that's kind of amazing. A lot of those searches come from places where pandas aren't, you know, just don't exist. Like, you know.
Right. What are you going to do? Steal them from the National Zoo or something?
Yeah, exactly. So there's a lot of those kind of things which are just so interesting. And then some of it is, also, you see these searches, which are, if some things are about as being the same, some things are about as being wildly different. So, for instance, if you look at searches for kids' classes, in, like, Australia, it's, like, coding, which kind of makes sense. In Canada, it's boxing. In UK, it's parkour, you know, the thing, jumping from thing to thing.
Oh, yeah.
And in the US, it's etiquette or crochet. Both show up on the list, which is so not what I was expecting to see, but there you go.
Here you'd think it would be like, how do I get my kid into the best college?
Well, yeah, no, exactly. And those things definitely spike to, like, you know, back to school is always a big moment each year for sure.
One thing that I found surprising and yet wonderful is, and I think you've already mentioned it in our interview, is how to help others. And one of those you talk about at length is how to help a bee. Which is so wonderful, but then how to help others? I just love that. Tell me more.
How to help searches are really interesting because they're mostly about other people.
Yeah.
Like how to help someone with anxiety or depression comes up quite a lot, or how to help somebody who's grieving, as I mentioned. How to help a bee, I just love that, partly because it feels like the most English search ever, and it's like one of the countries where it spikes in June, which is always where you have this like full summer where you get a little bit of warm weather and the bees come out. And then cool weather, and they suffer. And yeah, when I was writing the book, my publisher has actually done that. He searched for how to help a bee, so obviously resonated. But yeah, the help stuff is really interesting, and you can see even if you look at the top causes that people donate to each year, and in the way they search for donate to ... it will reflect those moments where there's a hurricane or floods or refugee disaster or some other kind of natural event. You absolutely see that showing up in the data.
Wow, that's so wonderful. If you're just joining me on Cool Science Radio, I'm having a conversation with Simon Rogers. His new book is called What We Ask Google. And you have, I believe it's still in the introduction, where you give this little graphic of the top 20 searched questions. And it is so, I mean, it's surprising, but not surprising to me. Mm. But the number one is, what is my IP? You mean like IP address?
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, I don't always know why people do stuff. They're a real mix, aren't they? The kind of the informational like that. But there are also things like, where am I? You know,
which where am I?
Which I love. But also things like, you know, how to fall in love, or how do I know if I'm in love, or how to kiss. Things like that. There's kind of really a mix of the kind of the personal and sometimes quite sweet queries. And then there's things like how to make slime, which was a trend a few years ago, was this trend in making slime for kids. And there's a concurrent trend, which I love, which is how to get slime out of a carpet. So it's a real mix. It's just like, if that's partly why I say if you look at the data, you would understand everything about humans, because you can really see how ephemeral we are. You know, we care about one thing one moment, something else utterly the next.
Right. Well, apparently every school kid Or maybe every adult needs to know which dinosaur has 500 teeth, because this is number 16 on your list.
Yeah, I think it's just ahead of Where is Chuck Norris, which was a meme a few years ago as well. So there's like a lot of these things. Some of them are transitory. Like, I don't know if you remember loom bands. Oh, my kids loved loom bands. And you can see like loom bands would spike in search and then they disappear utterly because they were so popular at that moment. Last year, it's probably Labubus, you know, these things that really mattered to lots of people at the same time.
What was the most surprising search that has popped up for you, which is an unfair question because I'm sure there's so many surprising things. I mean, I'm sure you wade through lots of weird stuff, but...
Well, so it's weird because after 10 years, right, nothing really surprises me. There was a trend that I thought was that I loved finding, though, which was I was looking for searches around how to say thank you, because I think it kind of reflects quite a lot about who we are as people. We want to say thank you for stuff and we want to know how to do it. And there was this spike in searches for how to say thank you for an unexpected gift, which was spiking at the time when I pulled the data, was spiking in Niger in Africa. Now, I don't know anything about Niger as a country. Different to Nigeria, it's a different place. It has its own history, some of which is quite troubled. But I desperately was trying to think, well, how do I know that? I contacted like the US embassy in Niger. I'd contacted the Nigerian embassy in the US. I contacted a few people. And then in the end, I found this NASA hydrologist who was from Niger, Dr. Faji Miner. Is an amazing person. I sent her an email. I just said, sorry to bother you with this, but why, do you know why this might spike in Niger? Which is, you know, and she came back with some really interesting stuff about how Niger is has a tradition of gift giving. To the extent you turn up, you never turn up empty handed to somebody's house. Even if you have nothing, you turn up with an egg or something. You'd always turn up with something, and it's that cultural thing. So to see like this kind of ghost in the data in a way, this weird little very small trend coming from a specific place that then teaches me something about that place was so interesting to me. And it really kind of showed me how powerful that data can be.
Yes. Well, okay, Simon. So now you've written this book. It's just being released, I believe, in early May in the US.
Yeah.
Has it already been released in the UK?
It's out first in the US by a couple of days on May 5th.
Okay. So you've done it. You haven't yet seen sort of the response to it, but how do you feel? Does it make you feel happier about people, connection, the way things are going?
Yeah. I mean, I loved writing it. A lot of people say, oh, I hate writing books. I really loved writing it. I loved having that amazing focus. And it was so reassuring to me to see what the data said about us as humans. So I'm really excited to see what people think about that and if it resonates with them.
Absolutely. Well, best of luck to you. My guest is data journalist and author, Simon Rogers. His new book is What We Ask Google, and it dives into 20 years of Google searches. So interesting. Simon, thank you so much for joining me on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you.